Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Author Chats. I'm Elizabeth Kelly. On Author Chats, we feature in-depth conversations with writers about their recent works. And today, we are honored to have with us Professor James Forman of Yale Law School to talk about his important and compelling new book titled Locking Up Our Own: Crime and Punishment in Black America. While we wait for Professor Forman to come on the line, I'll talk a little bit more about this book. I first learned about Locking Up Our Own a couple of months ago when there was a year-end article written by the Crime Report of what were going to be the most influential books about the criminal justice system in America in 2018. And Professor Forman's book was listed. I contacted him and he was gracious enough to send me a copy of Locking Up Our Own, which I quickly read and scheduled this interview. Professor Forman focuses on our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., and he uses it to illustrate the reasons why there is the mass incarceration, the over-incarceration of people, not just in our nation's capital, but throughout the country. And one of the things he stresses again and again and again is it is the seemingly little decisions at the local level which pile on one after the other, which create the epidemic of mass incarceration and over-incarceration we have in this country. And he talks about the movement towards decriminalization of marijuana in our nation's capital. He discusses the gun violence in our nation's capital and attempts that were made to control it. And I see Professor Forman is on the line right now. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning.
While we were waiting for you, I did a setup of the book. So with that in mind, let's plunge right in to the conversation. I told our listeners that you focus on Washington, D.C. in order to discuss the over-incarceration, the mass incarceration of this country. Why did you focus on D.C.?
I focused on D.C. because I thought it was a fascinating case study in a way, because D.C. is a majority African-American jurisdiction. It has a long history of African-American majorities in the city council, African-American mayor. When I was practicing as a public defender in the 90s, African-American police chief, a majority black police force. The chief prosecutor in the city was Eric Holder, long before he would go on to become the attorney general. And so we know the story over the last 50 years, in some sense, of what's happened in this country building the largest prison system in the world. But what hadn't been told before had been a close look at the role that African-American leaders played over that 50-year period and the particular challenges that they faced as they tried to protect communities from crime and violence and addiction. And so I really wanted to look at the story of mass incarceration through the lens of African-American citizens, African-American officials, African-American judges, prosecutors, to put those voices front and central in the narrative. And D.C. was a perfect city to do that through and in.
And were you surprised by what you discovered in your historical exploration? For instance, with the whole issue of decriminalization of marijuana.
Yeah, so I was very surprised by that, and that's the first chapter of the book. It tells the story in 1975. There's a locally elected city council that is voted into office. For the first time, Washington, D.C., local citizens have some amount of control over their government. And that locally elected city council in 1975, 11 out of 13 members were African-American. And one of the first things that they considered was a proposal by a guy named David Clark, actually one of the two white members, to decriminalize marijuana. Now, given everything that we know today here in 2018 about the impact that marijuana criminalization has had on the black community, racial disparities in arrest rates, leading in some cases to job loss, leading to an inability to get student loans, public housing. Given all of that, you might have thought, and I thought, that back in 1975, when this majority black city council had a chance to decriminalize, that there might have been an appetite for that. And there was. The vote was close. It was very, very contested. But ultimately, decriminalization lost. And it lost in part, and this is what I think in some ways was the most fascinating part of the story for me. It lost not because African-American elected officials didn't care about the black community. Of course they did. It lost because some of the members of the city council were so fearful about drug use, and in particular fearful about heroin addiction, and worried that marijuana would be a gateway drug to heroin, that all of those fears came together to cause them to say, we're not going to allow this to be decriminalized. And so they did it out of a sense of care and concern, and in many ways out of a sense of love, even though in retrospect, as we look back, I think it was a mistake, and they would have been better off decriminalizing when they had that chance.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Author Chats. I'm Elizabeth Kelly, and we're talking with James Forman Jr., a law professor at Yale University, about his important book titled Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America. A few moments ago, you alluded to your time working as a public defender in Washington, D.C. Tell our listeners who may be unfamiliar a bit about PDS in Washington.
Absolutely. The Public Defender Service in Washington, D.C. was started in the late 1960s, and it was meant to be in many ways and has turned out to be a model public defender's office, a place where caseloads are kept reasonably low. When you're a lawyer there, of course, you still feel like they're too high, but by national standards, they're low, where funding for experts is available, where the training program is deliberately designed and well-crafted. There's 2 months of training. Two full months of training before you ever take your first case, which when you talk to most public defenders and they hear that, they just, they can't even believe it. And so it's an office that, because of its reputation and in all of those dimensions, attracts many, hundreds of applicants probably for every one that they're able to hire. And really has high and exacting standards. And it's a place where there's a real sense of mission among the lawyers. People feel like they're doing what they were called to do in this world. And we work long hours. We work with a lot of conviction and a lot of integrity and just a lot of energy and effort. And so it was an incredible place. I was there for 6 years. It was an incredible place to learn how to be a lawyer. And it was an incredible place, an incredible just community of advocates. We felt, in a lot of ways, we felt like civil rights workers. We felt, my mom and dad were both in the civil rights movement. And I remember when my mom visited our office, which at PDS, which was decrepit, but full of kind of life and energy and political posters on the wall and peeling paint. And my mom said, this reminds me of a movement office. And that's how we thought of ourselves. And I think they still think of themselves that way.
And one of the things I was struck about was how much you in the book cared about your clients, and you cared about them as a whole person. For instance, with Dante, the young man who was in trouble with the law, you quickly identified that he was very good with, I believe, woodworking, and you moved heaven and earth in order to find him some type of educational program so the judge would not send him to prison.
That's right. And I should say, I was just doing my job. I was doing what I had been trained to do, and what I had been, you know, equipped to do. And I think the level of effort and engagement that I put into that case would have been typical for a lawyer in my office. And it's something that we all would want our lawyer to do, right? If any of us were in that situation where we were facing that incredible, awesome power of the state, and we only had our lawyer to defend us, we would want them to work that hard. But yeah, in Dante's case, he had robbed a man. He had gone up to a bus stop and with a knife in his pocket, threatened a man and robbed him. And in so many cases, you know, that's where the story ends, right? We know that this is a, you know, teenager, African-American, committed a robbery, all the stereotypes and stigmas attached, and done, you know, lock you up. But as we know, as defense lawyers, there's always more. There's always more to the story. And as I began to explore Dante's past and I learned some of the struggles that he's faced, his mom was addicted to drugs. She wasn't able to provide for him. He really was kind of raised in the streets. And he struggled academically, but he did have this incredible potential with his hands woodworking. I saw the evidence of it in his house. I saw his carvings. And he had a woodworking teacher at his local high school who would vouch for him. And kind of with that, I went on this sort of effort to find a program for him all over the city. And the reason I use his story in the book, in part, is because he was convicted of a violent offense. And I want to try to get readers to see that we can't end the discussion with the label violent offense, violent offender, and move on. We have to look at people in their fullness, in their wholeness, in their individuality, no matter what the crime that they're convicted of.
Well, and as you point out in the book, part of the problem of just looking at the offense and not the person is the mandatory minimum sentence kicks in. Tell our readers or our listeners during the last few moments a bit about the rather complex rise of mandatory minimum sentences in Washington, D.C.
Well, it is a complex story, and I'll try to be brief, but mandatory minimums, as you said and as the name implies, are mandatory. If you're convicted of a particular crime, then the judge must impose at least this sentence with no discretion whatsoever. And that sounds sometimes to the general public fine, but again, if you think about the individual, it's often not fine, right? We want judges to know and be able to take into consideration the individual story, the individual life circumstances. In Washington, D.C., there was this incredible push to pass mandatory minimums in the late 70s, early 80s, as there was in many cities, because crime was rising and people were afraid. And politicians kind of latched on to mandatory minimums as an idea. And when citizens are afraid and one side is offering them something like mandatory minimums that sounds appealing and the other side doesn't really have anything to offer in return, then mandatory minimums tend to prevail. And that's what happened in D.C. in the early 1980s. What's changed in the decades since is that those of us that are opposed have started to figure out what are alternatives that work better, that are more creative, that will protect communities without causing the incredible harm and damage that long prison sentences do. And that's, I think, why we're at a turning point moment in this country.
And final question for you, what would be some of those creative solutions?
Well, there's a bunch of things that are going on now. There's a program out of Brooklyn called Common Justice. And what that is a restorative justice program where people who are victims of crime come together with people who have committed those crimes. And it's very intense. It's very emotional. It all starts with apology and accountability. The person who committed the crime, confronting what they've done, the harm that they've done. And then both the victim and the person who have committed the crime begin to get the treatment that they need, the drug treatment, the mental health treatment, the counseling. You know, one of the problems is we've typically just offered, we tell victims, well, what we're going to do to make you whole is we're going to lock up the person who robbed you, or the person who shot you, or the person who hit you. But people often want so much more than that. So restorative justice is a model that's growing around the country. There's another program out of Seattle that's grown nationally now, over 50 cities, called Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion. And what that does is that empowers police officers when they see addicts on the street, when they confront low-level drug sellers who often are addicts themselves. The police are empowered not just to lock the person up. The police are empowered instead to directly refer to the person to treatment programs, not give somebody a phone number and put them on a waiting list that lasts 9 months. That's what we normally do. But under LEAD, they're empowered to take the people directly to the treatment program with the consent of the person, of course. And they've seen in LEAD, they've seen that people that get the diversion into the drug treatment, as long as they get it right away that day and they enter into a program with bed space, they've seen significant reductions in recidivism, much greater than when you lock the person up. So Common Justice and LEAD are two of my favorite programs, but there are many more.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that. And thank you for joining us here on Author Chats. We've been talking with James Foreman, a professor at Yale Law School, about his important new book titled Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America. I'm Elizabeth Kelly. Thanks for joining us. Please remember, injustice anywhere threatens justice everywhere. Have a good day.